You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
There are certain times when it seems like kismet or something, because we are having, as you know, the second edition of our Talking About Race lecture series with the Open Society Institute of Baltimore. And I couldn't think of a better time to be having this. And I have here in my notes, intelligent, educational, and maybe controversial discussion. And as you know, race, once a taboo subject, has definitely been the centerpiece of news stories and debate all summer long and into the fall. From arrests to heckling to all types of things, the topic of race has been brought up and brought into the conversation. So we couldn't think of two better men and also a better forum to talk about the question, do we still need to talk about race? And we'd like to thank, as the Edith Bradfrey Library, our partner in this special series, the Open Society Institute of Baltimore. And this evening would not be possible without their hard work and dedication to making Baltimore a better place to live for everyone. And I just want to give them a hand, their board members here. Some of you were with us when we kicked off the lecture series last June with award-winning journalist Gwen Ifill and civil rights attorney Sherrilyn Ifill, who's also on the board of the Edith Bradfrey Library and Open Society Institute, and we had a packed house to really start these conversations, and we will continue that, and we hope we can duplicate that intensity tonight. More than a century ago, philanthropist Enid Pratt gave the city of Baltimore more than $1 million, and that was in 1882, and you can imagine the present value of that gift today. To make sure, and in 1882, this was very significant, very different in Baltimore, that this public library, quote, remained free for all without distinction of race or color. And that was something really significant to say in the city at that time. And because of his pretty fearlessness right then, his legacy has benefited thousands and generations of Baltimoreans. Several months ago, after our series started, an older gentleman who had been at the lecture series sent us a donation, and he told us that he will continue to support the Pratt financially, even now that he lives in the suburbs, because the Pratt was the one place that welcomed him despite his race when he was growing up in Baltimore. And his story, like those of many others, is a true testament to the importance of a free public library in this city. In the coming weeks and starting tomorrow, we hope some of you can be here for the opening reception of a special exhibit curated by Professor Larry Gibson, NAACP Baltimore Branch, 97 years and counting. And on your way out, you might get a chance to see some of the exhibit. It's a wonderful exhibit from their archives, and Mr. Jealous will also be here tomorrow night. We also have in the upcoming weeks the CBS News correspondent and Baltimore native, Byron Pitts, who will be here, and one of our favorites, award-winning writer, Dr. Cornel West, will be here again. And this program and others wouldn't be possible without generous contributions and supports of our donors, just like PBS and all that. You see that? That's the same thing with the Pratt Library. But we are so pleased that at the time when libraries are needed most, we hope that you will continue to support the Pratt. We just received our last annual statistics. There was a 32% increase in the number of people visiting Pratt Libraries. Amazing. We just got in today's city paper voted, when they have best of this, best of that, and they usually have best branch, and they pick a branch. This year they said, anyone you can go to. Yeah. And that was like, finally. And in one of my favorites, the September issue of Washingtonian Magazine that has the fall getaways, and it has all these great day trips from Washington and stuff, they mention Baltimore, and right under the Basilica is a great place to go, is this Central Library. and they put that in there, and so that's really cool. They even mentioned our new cafe. We are entirely wireless. We're going to be wireless in all of our branches by the end of this calendar year, and we'll be loaning laptops out to people in the central library. So when you come in, you can get a laptop, use it in the library. But we're working on the other stuff. So we've got a lot of good stuff. And so we just thank you for your support and being there with us. And so now to introduce and get the evening going is the director of the Open Society Institute in Baltimore, a woman who's done so much for this city, Ms. Diana Morris.
Having a more wonderful partner to kick off this series and continue it throughout this year, and also to have a find a better, more welcoming place than this library. And in the spirit of all that this library does for our community, I want to also just tell you that outside there's this excerpt from our newsletter, Books That Changed Our Lives and Our Thinking. And they're all books that have to do with race and race relations that some of us picked as very important books in our own lives. So use this library to find these books and others that really matter to you. As Carla said, this is a year-long series that we're very happy to be launching with the Enoch Pratt Library. And since we started this series, we've just had a wonderful response. People have said this is something that is so important, that it's overdue, that it's timely, that we got to get started, and that they're so happy that there's a real opportunity to come together and talk about some of these tough issues. And as Carla also said, in light of so many events that have happened just recently, just this summer, and I'll say very specifically, the very unfortunate arrest of Professor Henry Louis Gates on the porch of his own house in Cambridge, and then very specifically the unfortunate comments by Congressman Joe Wilson shouting "you lie" during President Obama's address, we're certainly convinced that it's really more important than ever, really imperative that we discuss race and really think through how it plays a role in our society. As we've noted before, the issue of race is one that we at the Open Society Institute touch upon every day as we do our work to try to really increase opportunity and justice in our community, especially for those people who have been historically or currently discriminated against. Our work in Baltimore focuses on three interconnected issues: tackling drug addiction, focusing on over-reliance on incarceration, and also focusing on the obstacles that impede our youth from succeeding both in and outside of the classroom. In a city where 65% of the population is African American, and where we have a growing immigrant population, and where many of our residents live in poverty, we recognize that the issue of race is implicitly involved in everything we do and everything that we're trying to improve. We know that we need to continually ask ourselves how historical and institutional racism affect current and future conditions. And we believe that it's really critical for us to listen closely and understand more deeply each other's experiences relating to race relations, discrimination, and opportunity. So we're very excited about our event tonight. But before we actually meet our presenters, all of whom are now here, I'm happy to say, I want to tell you about some upcoming events. The next event after this is going to be Can We Talk About Race? How Race Affects Our Classroom. And that discussion is going to feature Beverly Daniel Tatum, who many of you know is the president of Spelman College, as well as David Hornbeck, who was the former superintendent of schools in Philadelphia and now is a Baltimore resident. That's going to take place on November 2nd, right here, at 7 o'clock. I also hope that you'll listen to the radio station WYPR, which is featuring a segment entitled Across the Divide, Stories About Race, right here in Baltimore. And this is going to be a series of personal stories told by people from our own community about the experiences they've had about race that changed their lives. We've actually started a new web page that will allow you all to participate. It's www.storiesaboutrace.org, www.storiesaboutrace.org. And you can tell your own stories about race and submit them on that and place them on that website. The series is going to culminate in a live performance as part of the Stoop Storytelling Series at the Center Stage in February. So your story may be chosen if you're interested. So I would urge you all, because this is a series that I think is just getting richer and richer with different people's interests and different institutions' interests, so please keep a look at our own website, which is www.osi-baltimore.org, so you'll have more information about these additional programs. But right now, I'd like to turn to our session tonight and introduce the three people who are going to be part of our conversation. And I'd actually like to ask them to join me on the stage right now, please. We designed these programs to be a series of conversations about race, and therefore, as you see, we have three very comfortable chairs for our guests. And we've also asked Judge Andre Davis to serve as the moderator. He'll throw out the first questions this evening. He'll also participate in the discussion. But you all will have a chance, too, because he's going to lead a question and answer session towards the end of the conversation, which will give you a chance to participate. Now, as a quick introduction, I want to start with the most important thing first, which is that we're so proud to say that Judge Davis has been a member of the OSI board since the very inception of our work here. On the other hand, he has some other things to his credit. He is the U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland judge. He's a judge serving there now. But earlier this spring, President Obama nominated Judge Davis to serve on the Fourth U.S. Circuit. So we're all hoping that his confirmation by the full Senate is weeks, if not days away. Very exciting for all of us and for the rule of law. Let me now introduce also the two speakers who we are very pleased to have with us. One is Ben Jealous, living right here among us in Baltimore. He is the 17th president and chief executive officer of the NAACP. And as many of you know, the youngest person to hold this position in the organization's nearly 100-year history. Before his appointment, to the NAAC, Ben Jealous served as the president of the Rosenberg Foundation, a really wonderful private foundation that supports civil and human rights advocacy to benefit California's working families. And prior to that, he was the director of the U.S. Human Rights Program at Amnesty International. While he was there, he led efforts to pass federal legislation against prison rape, to rebuild public consensus against racial profiling, especially in the wake of 9/11, and to expose the widespread sentencing of children to life without parole, which is such an important issue, including right here in Maryland. He's also served as the executive director of the National Newspaper Publishers Association, and that's a federation of more than 200 black community newspapers. And while he was there, he rebuilt its 90-year-old national news service and launched a web-based initiative, which is more than double the number of black newspapers publishing online. We're also so pleased to have Gerald Torres with us. He's a leading figure in the critical race theory discussions, as well as an expert in agricultural and environmental law. Since 1993, he has been serving as professor at the University of Texas Law School. He's a co-author, as many of you know, along with Harvard Law Professor Lonnie Gonier, of The Miner's Canary, Enlisting Race, Resisting Power, Transforming Democracy. This landmark book was described by Publishers Weekly in 2002 as one of the most provocative and challenging books on race produced in years. And it remains a powerful commentary, of course, to this day. He currently serves as the chair of the board of the Advancement Project, which has offices in D.C. and L.A., a national organization that's very important, and he's past president of the Association of American Law Schools. He was honored with the 2004 Legal Services Award from the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund for his work to advance the legal rights of Latinos. So welcome all. We look forward to this conversation.
Well, good evening.
Let me take just a moment of personal privilege and express for myself and many of you out there our gratitude to Dr. Hayden for opening her space to us. Being here tonight is such an unmitigated joy for me as I remember back 50 years sitting on the floor of branch number 5 of Union Track on Broadway between Madison and Ashland Avenue, soaking up the love and the knowledge and the joy that is what learning is all about. And it's stayed with me all my life, and I'm really pleased that you are here and that we are here to have this conversation. Ben, Daryl, we sit here in the closing weeks and months of the first decade of the 21st century, an extraordinary moment in the history of this country, a black president, the strongest person in the world, occupying the White House. The question tonight is, in that light, do we still need to talk about race? Have we reached the point of ultimate racial equality in this country? Are we there yet? Do we really need to keep talking about this stuff? Ben?
You know, that would seem like more of a question even a couple weeks ago. God bless President Carter. God bless Carter, as good as he, Doc Cheatham. And it's also just good to be in my second home of Baltimore. I spent all my summers here. My mom grew up here, desegregated Western High School. Parents met here. Dad desegregated lunch counters downtown. You know, that question would have been more of a question, I think, months ago. Unfortunately, we've been pulled in to this erratic, mean-spirited national conversation with racial, with really pronounced racial kind of currents running off through it. You know, we can't be post-racial until we're post-racism. But we can't even hope to get there if we can't get this national conversation back to a place that is civil. You know, we have to realize that the Klan and hate groups in this country have been revived and revived again. And we're in a moment right now with the rise of hate TV on top of hate radio that's inviting that sort of renaissance of white supremacist activity and overt racism. What's at stake is perhaps different now than it has been in the past, because I'll kind of close on this, that we probably have the largest group of completely sort of ambiguous on the subject, undecided people who could really go either way that we've ever had. And the smallest numbers of dedicated racism, because they've died off, the biggest number of people who really are committed to a multiracial, egalitarian society. And so we have to understand that there is a war right now for the hearts and minds of that big group of people who are undecided, who could go, you know, the types of folks we saw during the primary in New Hampshire, you know, friends who were there calling back saying, yeah, I had guys who were crying. They didn't know what, they wanted to vote for McCain in the primary, they wanted to vote for Obama in some of the states where you could switch, and they just didn't know which one. Those are the folks that we're trying to capture right now. And so we really have to think, I think, very intentionally about how we talk. We need to be very clear that that's the audience that we're going for. And we have to go out and we have to go after them with the same level of gusto that we catch from Glenn Beck.
I would agree that you know we are at an important moment, and it's important. The way you phrased the question, of course, was provocative. You know, what it made me think of course, was you described President Obama as the most powerful man in the world, right? And what it made me think of was, you know, Jack Johnson. You know, and when Jack Johnson became heavyweight champion of the world, right? The heavyweight champion of the world, right, is supposed to be the baddest man in the world, right? And what did it spawn in the United States, right? But was an international campaign, right, to try to get someone to dethrone him, right? And what we finally moved in sports, right? We finally moved past that. To be able to respect quality and respect leadership and respect achievement, and you have the president here, who in fact did win a resounding victory in November, and what you have is a small core of people who are resisting that victory and trying to use, I think, elements of the past to resist that victory. And it really is incumbent upon us, and this, if we learned anything from this summer, I think the thing we learned is we need to organize. That November wasn't enough. That If the president is going to get his agenda passed, if we think that we need to continue the anti-racist discussion, and the anti-racist discussion isn't just about anti-racism, but about getting a program that is good for all Americans, then we need to organize. And if it takes the form of combating racism, then it's got to take that form too. And that's what we need to do.
That perhaps was a macro view of things expressed by these two distinguished gentlemen, but let's take it down to a micro level perhaps. Here on the stage tonight sit three men of color who, let me say with all due modesty, have in some ways reached, if not the pinnacle of their professional pathways, certainly among the highest reaches. A Rhodes Scholar who leads one of the, if not the preeminent, civil rights and human rights organizations in the history of the world. A tenured professor at one of the top law schools in the United States, a scholar of renown, and a judge serving the people of America with a lifetime appointment to the federal bench. Isn't that proof positive that race simply has been overcome as an issue or as a barrier to success?
I guess we all go home now. Would that it were true. Would that it were true. I mean, the reality is that if it were true, that we're it's emblematic of something. And what it's emblematic of is that we have come a long way. And I think it would be a mistake to say that this society hasn't changed. The fact that we have a black president, the fact that a lot of
a lot of interracial relationships have emerged, that some of the grossest forms of racism are no longer permissible. I think that a lot of things have changed, and I think it would be wrong to say that the society hasn't progressed. But when you have a situation, right, that the median net worth of the white Americans is still $90,000 a year, and the median net worth of African American families is $6,000, right? Then you have to say things haven't changed in a way that allows us to say we can all go home, the job is done. Because it means that we are now in a position to take the good fortune that we've had and to put it to use, to put it to work. And so, you know, I'm not, for one, I'm not going to sneeze at the good fortune, you know. But all it means is, you know, to whom much is given, much is demanded. So, you know, it's time to get to work.
You know, we have to acknowledge how much has been gained, how far we've come. The jobs that we hold show that, in my case, the scholarship I won showed that the barriers have become more permeable. But the point of our work isn't to make the barriers more permeable. The point of our work is to make sure that there are no more barriers. That there are no more barriers. At this moment, you know, racism is a bit like an onion. You peel off one layer and there's the next. At this moment, racism is both more permeable and more volatile than it has been. Throughout much of my childhood, throughout all of my parents' and grandparents' lives, the primary layer of, was the primary justification, the top layer, if you will, of racism in this country was presumed inferiority. Right? The notion was we couldn't be the coach. We couldn't be the quarterback. We couldn't be the CEO. We couldn't be on the golf course unless we were the caddy. And then Tiger Woods and General Powell and Obama and Oprah, and that argument that black people simply can't be excellent is pretty much thrown out the window. You can have an entire southern white family where every generation has a black hero, right? General Powell, Oprah, Obama, Tiger Woods, what have you. You peel back that layer, and what you're left with is presumed criminality. Presumed criminality. And that's what we're dealing with right now. And the reason that it's more volatile is because if I suspect that you're inferior, well, that may not ever go away, but it also makes inclining to be somewhat benign, to take pity on you, offer you a job as a driver. But if I think of you as a criminal, well, first of all, the last job I'll offer you is as a driver. So, for instance, in cities across this country, it's almost impossible for black men to get jobs, the studies have shown, even as garbage collectors without a criminal background check. A study comes out of UCLA that says that it's the best interest of most black men for every employer to do a criminal background check because most employers assume all black men are criminals. Then you have a study came out of the same year, this is both about 2-3 years ago, out of Princeton, that said that it was easier for a white man with a criminal record to get a job than a black man without. A white man with criminal records right there, stated clearly, got more callbacks for job interviews than black. So you read between the lines, and what it suggests is that the white guy who says he's a convict is being treated like the honest crook, because he tells you, and the black man who says that he's not, because he really ain't, is treated like the lying crook. Now, it becomes more volatile because if I think that you're a criminal, well, there's virtually nothing I won't do to protect my family from you. And if I think that somebody else reasonably thought you were a criminal, then there's not very much I won't accept them doing either. And that's the context in which we live. It's more permeable because once you're vetted, once you're known, you know, then you can get the cab because they know you're the president of the U.S., right? Or they see you walking out of their corporate headquarters. Yeah, his cousin may not be able to get the cab, but he can get the cab, right? You know, they don't shrink back on the elevator because they know that you're the SVP of sales or that you live in the penthouse. But until that point, until you're known, until, you know, you're in that space of familiarity, you're in the space of complete anonymity, and that's a very dangerous space. That's the space where Diallo died in New York. That space of anonymity, where he sees himself as a hard-working vendor. If you just pull out his wallet and show the cops his ID, everything will be okay. Before he can do that, he shot 41 times.
Okay, if there is a need to talk about race, I'd like each of you to address the question of what is the value of talking about race in a public forum such as this. Is it the case that forums of this sort, conversations of this sort, actually add to people's understanding, or does it subtract from people's understanding? And ultimately, does it change anything, or is it possible that it might?
I suspect that most of us here are the choir. So it would be reasonable to ask, well, what's the purpose of preaching to the choir? You preach to the choir so that the choir is motivated to serve as evangelists until they come back to choir rehearsal. That's why you preach to the choir. Yeah, as the professor has laid out, we have to organize. We are in a defensive posture on healthcare because we were so bold as to believe that we could define and define the status quo. That what was going to go down in Washington is what we wanted to go down in Washington, because the combinations in Washington, who's in the Senate, who's in the House, who's in the White House, have been defined by progressives in this country. We have the dominant position. And then we got out Alinsky'd by the anti-Alinskyites.
Come on.
We're the masters of those tactics, right? We're the ones that they crib from. And they're schooling us right now. And so, you know, I'm here to talk about it, not because I think there's any great disagreement between us and the audience, but rather to simply ask people to fight, to commit, to be unwilling to feel comfortable and sated until we've made the country, till we've made the vision real that motivates so many people to vote in that transformative election last fall. We are in a moment right now where we have a large group of undecided people. And what that means is that we can move one way very quickly or the other very quickly. And the people who will decide whether or not we move forward quickly or backward quickly are the people like us. If we fight, we go forward. We go from good to great, just like the Obama campaign did, and we win. If we sit by and we say, well, we've got the right person in Congress and the right person in the Senate, and they're in the majority, that day will last about this long, and we'll be hurried backwards as far as the politics of this country just as quickly as we're rushing backwards when it comes to talk TV.
Sure. Yeah, I want to go back to the question of whether it makes sense to talk about race, right? Whether that talking about race in public fora like this makes sense, and I think it does. And one of the points that Lonnie and I made in our book, which I urge you all to buy and read, it makes an excellent gift. I actually think it reads better in hardback than softback. I'm joking, of course. No, but is that race makes some things visible. Right? When you notice race, you notice other things. Right? So that when you notice race, right, you notice the decline of the black middle class. And so you ask yourself, what are the mechanisms that are causing the black middle class to decline? Then you ask yourself, are those same mechanisms causing the middle class to decline for non-black people? Is it just that because you notice race that has caused you to notice that, for instance, predatory lending that created the mortgage crisis, right, is affecting the black community more harshly than the white community because they were the ones to whom they were pitched and more targeted. That ultimately led to the crisis, one of the things that led to the crisis that we saw. Well, if you didn't notice race, you wouldn't have seen that other thing. Let me give you an example from Texas. Right, when affirmative action was banned in Texas, right, one of the things we said we looked at who was getting admitted to the University of Texas. If we hadn't looked at race, we wouldn't have noticed that historically the freshman class at the University of Texas was being filled by 10% of the high schools in the state of Texas. It's a public university. 10% of the high schools were filling 75% of the freshman class. Okay? If we hadn't looked at race, we wouldn't have noticed that. Race caused us to see that. So talking about race causes us to see things that we would otherwise not see. It makes visible some things that would otherwise be invisible. So talking about race matters. Right? It doesn't mean we're blaming people for stuff, or we're looking for victims, or we're looking for perpetrators. It says, let's see how our society works. Let's see how institutions work, who they're working for, who they're not working for. Because what you're going to find is, if they're not working for people of color, chances are they're not working for other people too. And those are the political allies that we can join hands together, link their fates together, and produce political change.
In her remarks a few moments ago, Diana Morris, of course, alluded to the incident involving the world-renowned scholar at Harvard, Henry Louis Gates, and the incident involving Dr. Gates at his home in Cambridge upon his return from an overseas trip, in which, in the course of a police intervention prompted by a 911 call, at the end of the day, he got arrested. And of course, we all are familiar with the comments of President Obama not long thereafter, and shortly after that, the so-called beer summit at the White House. Some of you will recall, as I do, just a few years ago, none other than President Bush himself came out very publicly and strongly in condemning racial profiling. It wouldn't be an honest conversation tonight, I think, if the gentleman didn't get a chance to weigh in on this question. The incident involving Dr. Gates and President Obama's response to it, both his initial response to it and then the ultimate response to it. So I call on them to offer their views and express, if they choose, whether either of them has himself been the subject of what he regarded as racial profile.
I don't want to tune into Oprah show, you know, but not that I have anything against Oprah show, the Gates Institute, the only issue about that I think we need to be careful about right, is for it to focus people's attention on just the interpersonal kind of racism that it contains, right, and to allow to divert our attention from the structural impact of the incarceration and the criminality that Ben of black men that Ben was talking about earlier, because Glenn Lowry actually wrote a very powerful op-ed in the New York Times that got actually almost very little attention, and it was actually a really powerful op-ed, because what he said is the incident should have allowed us to focus on the way in which black men in general get treated by police. And it's obviously a mistake that was made, but it's a mistake that is common. And we need to focus on why that mistake gets made. I thought the president's engagement in it was a teachable moment for the country also, but it then, of course, spawned the flip side for the talk radio and right-wing television to spin its side of the debate and turn it into an idea of white people against black people, and ignore kind of the structural elements of the problem. And I think by taking our eye off the structural elements of the problem, we ignore the bigger problem. Have I ever racially profiled that yet? Sure. I mean, in my life, absolutely. I mean, in high school, I was stopped 9 times in 2 years, right? For various things, I was once strip searched on the street, for armed robbery. I was accused of armed robbery, I was in 9th grade. I was walking home from school. Did I commit armed robbery? Of course not. Right, it was for, the cops were on the toot, they want to see you stand naked in the street.
Before I hand the mic to Ben, could you say just a little bit more about what you refer to as a structural problem?
Yeah, I think the structural problem is there are two problems. One is the belief in black criminality. One, so that if you see, if you see a black man, do you presume his criminality? First of all. Second, the issue of poverty. Second, if a person has been accused of a crime, do you make it harder for them to get a job? If you make it harder for them to get a job, which is true, right, then you build in the structural difficulty of them re-entering the job market, right? So the idea that they are going to be put in a position where they're going to be on the street and subject to police suspicion. The idea that they're going to be in, quote, neighborhoods where they don't belong, right? All of these fall into what I call, structural problems, but also segregation is a structural problem. Well, many of our cities, now I don't know enough about Baltimore to speak. But many of our cities remain quite segregated, right? Segregation is a structural issue, right? And segregation then produces disparate criminal justice enforcement, right? This is not to say that police are bad people, right? My uncle and my cousin are both policemen, right? And they try to do honorable and good jobs, I am sure. But when I say
structural problems. I'm referring to high unemployment. I'm referring to segregated cities. I'm referring to schools that push kids out. I'm referring to overinvestment in the criminal justice system. Let me give you an example. In when California passed Proposition 209, which made affirmative action illegal, okay, people said, oh, you know, Californians are just racist, right? And that you could say that's true. But you could also say, you know what? Californians were responding to, the parents were responding to a felt scarcity of higher educational opportunity for their children. They were blaming the wrong persons, right? But what also happened that year is that was the same year that California's spending on the criminal justice system, prisons at every level, city, county, and state, exceeded spending on education at every level. For the first time in the history of the state of California, spending on incarceration exceeded education. That was a public decision. So there was a scarcity in education, and people felt it, but they blamed the wrong people. They should have blamed the people who made the decision to put the kids in jail rather than in school, right? And when I talk about structural problems, those are the structural problems I'm talking about.
We are pleased at OSI, as many of you are aware, I know, that one of the things we really focus on is the issue of reentry and reintegration of ex-offenders back into the community in ways that will help enhance the ability to address that particular structural problem. Ben?
Yeah, and right now, actually, we have several of the nation's largest employers at the table talking about how they reduce unnecessary barriers to employment across the board for formerly incarcerated folks. I want to stay for a second where Gerald left off, and just tell you about a conversation I had in California while I was helping Obama win the primary season. I was in a church in Far East Contra Costa County. Church men's breakfast, which is now the center of the black community in Northern California, because black folks have been pushed out of the Bay Area by housing prices and so forth, and stretch all the way almost to the Sierra Mountains, the foothills around Sacramento. So the middle of the black community in Northern California is now what used to be Orchards. And I'm in this little CME church men's breakfast, 7 a.m. There's one brother there under 40. He's 28 years old. Call him Bobby. And Bobby was just sort of shy in the back of the room. His shoes were shining, his pants were pressed, his shirt was crisp. So he stood out. So I went up to him afterwards. I said, you know, hi, I'm Ben. Hi, I'm Bobby. He said, Bobby, what do you do? He said, I'm a school resource officer. I said, what's that? He said, I'm a Richmond PD at Richmond High. He said, Bobby, when'd you graduate from high school? He said, about 10 years ago, coming up on my 10th reunion. I said, that's great. I said, did you go to Richmond High? He said, yeah, of course. I said, did they have officers stationed in the high school when you were there 10 years ago? He said, no, of course not. I said, so why do they have one now? They had 20 years of gang violence in Richmond by the time he had graduated from high school. So I said, why do they have one now? He said, Columbine. He said, Columbine, of course. Yeah, you know, that's you know, the federal government, they apportion money for school resource officers after Columbine. Any school that wants one can apply for one. The funds come to the local police department. He said, I said, Bobby, he said, how many kids do you arrest each semester? He said, oh, well, you know, I arrest far fewer. I'll say hi to my friends over here. I arrest far fewer than the other officers at the school. I said, brother, that's understood. You're at church men's breakfast at 7 a.m. on a Saturday at 28 years old. You are a fine man. You are a good man. How many kids did you arrest last semester? He said, oh, 15 or 16. That's one a week in an academic semester. Key words from his statement, other officers, okay, at least two. Far fewer, he's doing far fewer, so they're doing far more. So there's two officers that say they're doing two a week. That's five kids a week. Can you imagine being in high school and watching five of your friends, just five kids you know, or just five kids get led away in handcuffs every week? So I said, Bobby, I said, how many of those arrests, was there even a 10% chance, just a 10% chance that that arrest helped prevent the next Columbine? And I don't know if you guys can hear happening. You know, my cousin Lenny Wilmore grew up over on Madison Avenue, but Lenny was a regional supervisor, still is, for the post office, and place in Baltimore, place in Philly, supervises those. And I remember years ago, I said to Lenny, we're going to have to buy you Kevlar underwear for Christmas. People keep going postal. And Lenny said, be real clear where I work. I work in Harlem, I work in Philadelphia, I work in West Baltimore, I work in D.C. I might get shot walking to the post office. But those are good jobs, Mark. Don't worry about me once I get to the post office. So I said to Bobby, how many, you have a 10% chance you prevented the next Columbine? He said, none, of course. I said, of course? He said, none. I said, why? He said, because that happens in Columbine. I said, all right. So I said, well, then, you know, what are you locking up all these babies for? Right, these little kids, 13-year-old, 14-year-old. He said, biggest reason? I said, yeah, the biggest reason. He said, acts of defiance. And I said, Bobby, what's an act of defiance? And he said, well, you know, not backing up when I say back up. Being loud in class persistently, being tardy persistently, coming out the hallway when you're, you know, without a hall pass. Frankly, this is what I looked forward to when I was in the eighth grade. We managed to get along in this country for like 225 years without locking up kids for puberty. It's a way for the police department to get subsidized and make sure that they have one more job. And meanwhile, five kids a week in our community are getting a record. And we told you how hard it is for a black man without a record to get a job in low wage. So imagine what it is to be a young black man with a record. So how many jobs is that costing us for that one job in our community, right? The reality is that we may need that officer near that school. We may need him walking a beat around that school. In Philadelphia, you have an 8 in 10 chance of getting away with murder. 20% of the homicides get closed each year. Just 20%. San Francisco is only 30%. The thing that makes the difference, the strongest weapon you can have in a war to close homicides, are beat officers. Because they get to know people in the community and they can pass them information without walking over to a SWAT car or walking into the station. But we don't need the officer in the school, because that stuff happens in Columbine. Meanwhile, Columbine has not requested one of these officers.
Actually, Ben, your comments really provide a segue into my next question, and that was our future, our hope. How do we engage young people in this conversation? It's a school night, but you look out there and we don't see a whole lot of young people. That's can be explained. There are a few. How do we engage young people? Where do we go to engage young people? And how do we overcome the effects of two generations removed from the civil rights movement? And your thoughts on that will be very welcome.
If you want to know whether or not a legendary civil rights organization, a human rights organization, is on its way to being merely ordinary or will remain extraordinary, you look at the position of young people in the movement. If young people are out front, it should remain extraordinary. If young people aren't anxious to find Sandbox on the side with the kids' campaign of the year, it's on its way to being ordinary. I'm working very hard at the NAACP to get young people out in front of everything that we do. My grandma used to watch the kids from time to time for Juanita Mitchell when my mom was growing up in McCullough Holmes' first half of her life. My mom gets desegregated to Western High School when she was 14, but in the summertime, she would go down to Petersburg to take part in lunch counter sittings. And once in a while, I'm so intense, go meet my mom. She may have desegregated Western High School, taking a risk for other young people, their dignity, their opportunity. But she went to the lunch counter sitting for everybody. We didn't just send young people to lunch counters so that young people could eat at lunch counters. We sent the lunch so everybody could eat at the lunch counter. So everybody's dignity would be respected. We have to make plain to young people, we want to get more young people involved. One, there's a place for them, and it's in the front. Two, exactly what the stakes are. We are slipping into the third generation of the school to prison pipeline this time. The third generation. If you look at where the rates of incarceration of black people started to take off towards where they are now, five times those of whites, from where they had been for almost 100 years, if we've been counting statistics since just after the Civil War, at roughly one to two times those of whites. It was around 1970. So here we are 40 years later, two generations later. And we still have issues acknowledging how serious that is. You know, I was told, spending my summers around people like Judge Bob Watts, young man, all the great victories have been won. It's the end of history for black people, if you will. We killed Jim Crow just like we killed his daddy. Your job is to study hard, to play by the rules, because the rules are fair now, and to get rich. I can remember being 20 years old at Columbia University celebrating a friend's 21st birthday. And in a sort of faux nationalist Tribe Called Quest moment, somebody pouring libations first to all of our friends who had died before we got to college, and then to celebrate that one more of us had made it to 21. As if it should be an accomplishment in the greatest democracy on the planet and the richest country on earth for any man of any demographic to survive to 21. In other words, these children of the dream, these kids who were born after all the great fights had been won, we came of age just in time to find ourselves the most incarcerated people on the planet and the most murdered generation in this country. The elders in our community have to affirm how outrageous the times we live in are right now. Right now. When you have a young person who feels scared, who feels overwhelmed, who feels disconnected because they feel scared, they feel overwhelmed, the lesson about the past shouldn't be that we want everything and everything's cool now, you need to stop yapping. The lesson needs to be, this is how we dreamt big, this is how we broke it down into achievable steps, this is how we won, by maintaining the tradition. I'm a fifth-generation member of the association, so I know a little something about this. The tradition that says, to whom much is given, much is expected, the tradition that says every time that you gain an ounce of privilege, even if it's just making it into the ninth grade, you turn around and you take half an ounce of that privilege and you reinvest in somebody behind you.
How to intervene at the middle school level and how to deal with race at the middle school level and how to produce success at the middle school level if we start with the premise that the state was not going to invest a dime in schools. That is, and so what we did is we recruited some people, we got in cars, and the first thing we did, we assembled all of the experts, and we had a meeting in Austin, Texas, where I'm from, and we had them tell us how you produce a great school, and we dutifully took notes and produced a report, and then we put the report in the drawer, and then we got in cars, because we identified all the poor schools, the Title I's, the schools where free lunch were served, that were producing academic excellence and were schools of color. And we drove around and we interviewed people and found out how they were dealing with race and how they were dealing with academic success. And we said, what can we do? And how we can produce a model. And we tried to produce a model. And we tried to replicate that. And so that's one way to try to figure out what people in the community who are our generation, who are down in the community doing work and producing success, what are they doing? What lessons can we learn from the communities? And how can we bring that up and teach the experts? Because the real experts are, no, I shouldn't say this, I'm an academic. The real experts are the people who are doing it, you know, and you need to learn from them, and they need to see that it's the people who struggle to produce that success that we need to honor and reproduce their success and push it into the official systems. And, you know, I agree with Ben, that's exactly what we have to do. And that's one way you give back. So that's one way you reinvigorate the younger generation, by showing them the path through, right? Showing them the path through, and showing them that you learn from the people who borrow the expression, made the path by walking.
So we'll bring it to a close, perhaps for this phase with this question, which I suspect is rather obvious. The question has to do with what role, what voice, what possibilities are there for cross-racial efforts to enhance the conversation and indeed enhance the quality of life for all of us. We here in Baltimore, first of all, some people don't know that the NAACP was founded by a group of cross-racial individuals who came together in the spirit of goodwill to address problems 100 years ago. And that spirit has lived on in the NAACP all these many years. Here in Baltimore, we've had heroes like the late, great Walter Sondheim, who reached across the racial divide on more than one occasion. And you'll forgive me, but I have to recognize Senator Paul Sarbanes, who is here. Who absolutely exemplifies that spirit of goodwill and efforts in that regard. So I'd like the two gentlemen to address themselves to this question of, do we have a reasonable expectation of coalitions and cross-racial efforts to move the conversation?
I would say yes, absolutely. Absolutely. What I want to do is like give her a stand up and jump and shout. Because the answer is yes. And I want to give two real life examples and one example that I think Sandy Darity proposes. One is, when I was in the Department of Justice, one of the things President Clinton wanted to do was to produce an executive order on environmental justice. And so rather than just sit down and write an executive order on environmental justice for the president, what I did is I tried to identify environmental justice organizations around the country. I invited them into the Department of Justice to come and talk to me about environmental justice. And so I identified as many environmental justice organizations around the country as I could, and I said, come into the Department of Justice. And I set aside 2 weeks, and I had them come in and just talk to me. Just groups come in and talk to me. And the first thing I discovered
is that there was so much cross-racial organizing being done in the environmental justice area that I hadn't even been aware of it. And you know why there was cross-racial organizing being done in environmental justice? Because poor people know when they're being poisoned. You know, poor people know when they're being taken advantage of. And they said, you know, that poison doesn't know whether I'm black or whether I'm white or whether I'm brown. It knows that it's coming into my community and I need to organize, and they're choosing my community because I'm poor. Right? There were black organizations, there were white organizations, there were brown organizations, but there are also white, black, and brown organizations. And they came into the Department of Justice and they talked to me. I said, you know what? There's something going on in America. And I need to find out about it. Right? So that's one. Environmental justice is one place where you're going to see interracial organizing going on. And I think we need to feed it. We need to find out where these organizations are. And we need to help them build. And we need to, it's one area of environmental work where we need to continue to work. The other example, I hate to do this again to y'all, but I'm going to go back to Texas. And that was the 10% plan. I know a lot of people don't like the 10% plan, right? But when affirmative action is outlawed, what we said is, look, okay, you know, 10% of the freshman class comes from, 10% of the high schools fill up 75% of the freshman class. We want to adopt a new rule. We want the rule to be that if you graduate in the top 10% of your high school class, you're automatically eligible to come to the University of Texas. Okay? Now, Texas is the third most segregated state in the country. Okay? So suddenly that meant you had more black and brown kids eligible to come to the University of Texas and more poor white kids eligible to come to the University of Texas than had ever been eligible in the history of the University of Texas. You had counties that were 100% white and poor that had never sent a student to the University of Texas in the entire 150-year history of the University of Texas. These were counties that were reliably conservative, and you went there and you gave them the data, and suddenly you had guys voting with representatives from the 5th Ward of Houston. You know? And the people who are going to save the 10% plan aren't going to be the black representatives from the 5th Ward or the brown representatives from the Valley. They're going to be those conservative Republicans from West Texas. And that, the reason is because it's fair. And you have people say, well, you know, it's not fair because some high schools are better than others. And you know, you say, well, you know, that's right. Some high schools are better than others. But they're all public high schools. You know, I think all the public high schools ought to be equally good. So that a kid growing up in Del Rio or Plano or the west side of Houston or Dimmitt or Muleshoe all get the same quality education. So when they come to Texas, they're equally well prepared. And if you think they're not prepared, you go tell their parents. Because I'm not going to do it. We have established a cross-racial coalition for equal access to higher education in Texas based on the idea that higher education ought to be open to talent. Now, it's under continual assault every time the legislature meets. Private schools hate it because private schools don't rank. And it will be changed. You can mark my words. It will go away because ultimately, unless we can continue to organize, the powerful win. Right? But that's one, another place we can view cross-racial organization. And the final thing is, you know, organize, figuring out ways that we can address the question of unequal wealth, not unequal income, unequal wealth. Because all wealth is congealed income over generations. Right? And kids shouldn't be punished for the incapacity of our society and our economy that has prevented parents, for whatever reason, from being able to accumulate wealth over generations. Right? And Sandy, whether you want to create Bruce Ackman, Yale University proposes this, Sandy Darity Duke proposes this. Bonds that are available to children when they turn 21 that allow them to invest in college education or start a business, do whatever they want. Right? But to the idea of being able to overcome that wealth deficit, a black family would have to save 100% of their earned income for 3 years. That is not spend a dime on food, shelter, clothing, for 3 years, right, to match the wealth of the average white family. Right. People get punished, of course, the children. Right. And my question is, can we conceive of a way, and this is also, that mechanism also applies to poor white children too, not just poor, because we see it by books on race, right? Can we think of a mechanism to assist poor kids, to give them that leg up?
Well, and the mechanism may already exist. I mean, you have countries like the UK, where each child is given £5,000 at birth, put into an account that when they turn 18, they can have access to it. It gains interest, and they can use that to start a business, they can use that to go to college. Yeah, that's one of the ways. I think that Professor Torres brings a very good point. There is last talking about how it's important to use race to identify broad social problems, but then step back and look beyond that and ask who all is really impacted. We're in a moment now where our struggle really is a human rights struggle. It's not, a difference between a civil rights struggle and a human rights struggle is that a civil rights struggle is about enforcing the social contract, right? So when we were fighting in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, to enforce the 14th, 15th, 13th Amendment to the Constitution, we were seeking to enforce something that had existed for decades. Right? It's a contract that had been signed in the 19th century. And so it was a civil rights struggle because we were enforcing the rights that the government had guaranteed us in part of the civic body. A human rights struggle is about extending the social contract, about amending the social contract. A human rights struggle, the struggle against slavery, came to its apex in winning the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, and then turned it into a civil rights struggle to enforce those. Right? So, while the courts are often your primary tool for enforcing civil rights, because it's about enforcing a contract, it's like any other contract. Politics is your primary means for gaining human rights, for extending the contract, for defining the contract. The process of defining that contract is a battle, and you win with 51%. That means that it behooves us to be really crystal clear when we're dealing with an issue that's purely about race, or we're dealing with an issue that's about something else in which race is a factor. Going back for a second to Skip Gates' porch. If we had led with, this is about abuse of authority. If we had led with, this is about abuse of authority. This is about how officers abuse their authority again and again and again. I guarantee you. And then followed with, and race was a factor. In to what extent he abused his authority, we would have gotten further. If you look at the opinion polls, every single demographic in this country at significant levels has been a victim self-reporting of law enforcement abuse. Now, I'm not saying that black folks don't catch hell more, don't catch it more often. Most of the young people have left, they haven't apologized for that, but want to see her asleep. You know, don't catch it worse, don't catch it more, but then you're talking about race as something that defines the degrees. And the issue of law enforcement abuse, it's like the issue of payday lending. Right? Payday lending is more prevalent in the black community. Why? Because we started off with 85 grand less. Right? So we're more likely to need a short-term loan from something, you know, not be able to provide to ourselves or from a family member. But it doesn't know any color. And payday lending ranges from 350% to 1,200%. In California, where I lived before coming out here, most recently, it was 469%. And it was standing right above the window. I mean, you just walk in. We said, not even walk in, walk up to the glass window, look at the teller, look up, and it said, equivalent APR for a 14-day loan, 469%. Now, to put that in perspective, right, sharecropping was like 40% is the top rate. Range from 15 the low and 40 at the high end. People might be still angry about sharecropping. Top rate was 40%. Loan sharking, common rate is 520%. Why loan sharks? Ain't that bright. They just drop a zero, you borrow 50, you owe me 5 on it, you keep owing me 5 on it, and you pay back my 50. So at the low end, we're talking about something that's 10 times worse than sharecropping. At the high end, it's a 2.5 times as bad as loan sharking. It's completely legal. We have financial services regulatory reform moving like a fast train through Washington. And we have to be out there. You'll see the NAACP get out there this fall across the country. As we move towards the holidays, and people start increasing their use of predatory loans. One, to say don't let, you know, the shark kill salmon, right? Two, to say this needs to be part of financial services regulatory. Don't talk to me about reforming financial services, getting trust. And the financial, as long as loan sharking is legal, don't tell me that the stimulus is going to trickle down as long as 1.9 million families in California are paying 469%. And again, that's an example of an issue that it cuts across. What Professor Torres described in the 10% plan, that is what the future of affirmative action looks like in this country. And we have to understand that, and we have to get out in front of that. Repeat that. That is what the future of affirmative action looks like in this country. Why do I say that? Because Ward Connerly, we can keep off the ballot 3 out of 4 times. But when he gets on the ballot, he cleans our clock 8 out of 10 times. The question is, are we willing to get out in front of him? The purpose of affirmative action is to end inheritance as a substitute for merit. That's the purpose of affirmative action. Dr. King gave us a challenge in his letter from a Birmingham jail that we still haven't really ever wrestled with completely. In that letter, he says, we have to recognize that poor white prison guards have more in common with poor black prisoners and protesters than they don't. We have families in Eastern California, families in Appalachia, families in Western Maryland that have been locked, white families in the city, that have been locked out of opportunity for generations. And when you put in place a 10% plan, the reason you mix up the politics, you make it defensible, is because you recognize their utter humanity. And you actually get down to closer to the theological truth behind affirmative action than we've gotten to yet. Which is that in a democracy, you only realize true democracy when you can recognize the complete humanity of every human being in that society. I'm not talking about class replacing race or gender. That would be an utter failure. What I'm talking about is what exists on most college campuses. See, in public employment, public contracting, we tend to have two buckets. We have a bucket for race and we have a bucket for gender. But on college campus, you also have a bucket for class. So we give preference based on race. Why? Because black people have been discriminated against for centuries, continuing to today. We have a preference for gender. Why? Because gender oppression is real. And it's been real for centuries right up to today. And there's a bucket for gender, and what, I mean for class. And what that bucket looks like, it's geographic preferences, saying if you're applying from Appalachia, we'll give you a leg up. It's a first-time college. We're saying, look, nobody in your family's gone to college, regardless of what color you are, we'll give you a leg up. It's Harvard University saying, if your family's dirt poor, you're coming for free. The reality is that all those things will disproportionately impact black people, Latino people, Asian people, because we're disproportionately poor. But it also will create space for opening the doors for poor white Protestants. And quite frankly, poor white, multi-generational poor white Protestants, people have like absolutely no voice in the society except for the Ku Klux Klan. And are totally liable to being bamboozled by somebody like Glenn Beck, who, you know, let's not fool him thinking he's speaking up because he's not. But if we want to mix up the equation, then let's recognize and say, look, yes, we need to keep in place gender-conscious affirmative action. We need to keep in place race-conscious affirmative action. But just like the college campus, we also got to create a place for a white family that's been poor since they showed up here 100 years ago.
Please join me in thanking these two distinguished gentlemen. Thank you all for coming.